I mean, like, the crazy stat is that the last, is it like the last three out of the five last races in F1 have all been in Bahrain?
It's, yeah, it's something like 12 out of 15 days that we've seen a Formula One car last on track. It's been in Bahrain.
I tell you what,
being the exception.
I haven't got bored of it, though.
Bahrain's a great track, you know. I've only driven it once in a test in Formula 3, but it's good to drive. It's challenging on the tyres. But for racing, there seems to be that turn one to turn four sort of combination, even into turn six, you could say sometimes. It's just like cars are side by side all the time. And that extra DRS zone they have now, exit turn three to turn four, seems to keep it going for longer. But it's great. I mean, ever since 2014, I think, when we think about Hamilton and Rosberg, going side by side, it seems to be that every race, you know, I'm probably wrong there, but it feels like every race is just a cracker.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, with the Russell Mercedes last year, I think that was that, you know, the big oval, basically.
Yeah,
that was good.
Really,
it was like a semi-oval, wasn't it?
Wasn't really an oval.
Okay, what shape do you want me to describe
that? Bent circle, as all racetracks are called.
A wonky circle.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Wasn't really that much better for racing, that one, than the normal track, I didn't think.
It was just the drama.
Yeah, but if it wasn't for Russell being in the Mercedes, would you have enjoyed it that much?
Yes, because Perez came from the back and saw his way through.
Yeah. Yeah, he did, to be fair. But I don't know. I mean, you had Leclerc and Verstappen big going out on that first lap as well.
Yeah.
Starting from the back. But Mercedes messed up Bottas and Russell's stop. And Russell had a puncture, I think, as well, from the Williams that he was driving the week before. Debris. So I think there was a lot going on that helped that opinion of that track, to be honest.
Yeah, exactly. Are we seeing it again this year?
No, I think I heard it in commentary on Sky that they'd like to see it again, but I mean, I haven't heard it, and I would imply I think their conversation would imply that it's not planned at the moment.
I was speaking to one of my mates, a good friend of mine, Mika Pereth, about Bahrain, because he had a Bahraini sponsor, and he was out there on the bike, and he said it would make really good racing on a bike track.
Really? I wouldn't have thought that.
He said there's a couple of places where you can just absolutely send it. Well, like we see in F1.
I always thought bikes would suit Silverstone kind of thing more.
Yeah.
I mean, Bahrain, there's a lot of stopping and starting. When we go on the simulator for F1, there's very little high speed we talk about. There's just the one fast chicane. Turn 12 isn't even a corner. The one at the top of the hill. So it's just all sort of slow at medium speed, really.
Yeah. Like, you've got turn 1, 2, 3. Which in like three is like a flat out kink, isn't it?
Yeah.
On a bike, they would, you know, I reckon you get sort towards the end of the race and that would all get a bit loose. That would get quite
fun. Yeah, but it's the worst. I think it's the worst track in the world in terms of tyre deck. There's probably some, you know, there's probably one out in the Australian Outback or something that I've never heard of that's worse.
Yeah.
From the sort of like, you know, Grand Prix, MotoGP tracks, the MotoGP is pretty much, Bahrain is pretty much the highest in terms of deck.
Towards the end of the race, you'd be feeling like Mazepin on lap one. But
when I went there, it was a bit earlier in the year and it just wasn't as bad, it seemed, for tyre deck. But nevertheless, you are like a few seconds off at the end of the race compared to where you were at the beginning. But F1, I mean, the strategy wasn't that outrageous. It was just a two-stop, if I believe.
It wasn't anything too special, was it?
Hamilton went, I can't remember how many laps on his last stint, but obviously he was getting caught like a rocket from Verstappen. But he went a lot longer than when everyone expected, really.
Well, let's go, before we go into real details, should we start at the beginning? At the beginning. Well, before the beginning, actually. Sergio.
What, the channel of life?
We could start from Adam and Eve if we really want to, but I was going to say, before the beginning of the race and Mr. Perez.
Yeah, what was that all about? Yeah, I mean, I haven't really heard about what that was, but it seemed a bit, you know, when he pulled up a side of the track before turn 14, the last corner, it looked pretty terminal.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd only turned the race on like 5 or 10 minutes before the channel. So I hadn't heard that it apparently was kind of expected. He had some troubles on the reconnaissance laps, maybe. Right. So when he broke down, I was a bit surprised. And you know, when you see a car break down like that, you think that's terminal. When the dashes are off, like it's black. But obviously, these cars have some way to reboot the systems, a lot more than any car I've ever driven, obviously. And they seem to get it going. It just shows how technical they are, that thing can be struggling that much, and just a version of a control or delete can sort of bring the car back to life completely.
What on an F1 car would cause that? It's like, if you had to conspiracy theorist it, what do you think?
It's hard to say, but I mean, for it to stop like that and then keep going, again, you would say hardware would be the second or last place you would look. You would probably look to more towards software to begin with. But again, I don't know. And maybe it's come out in the press somewhere that I missed what the actual problem was. But, you know, I've experienced a lot with FE now, like I do on simulators and things like this. You see how critical software is that's written into the car, even just a few minutes before, or even on the grid. So it could have been anything, really. And I'm sure they kind of knew what it was, and it was just a case of trying, you know, trial and error, really. And it sounded like in the voice of his engineer that they'd kind of expected it when it broke down. But nevertheless, I mean, to start where he did, I think in the pit lane, or I think he started from pit lane.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, to start where he did and come through to finish fifth. I mean, that's pretty outrageous, to be honest. And it seemed like Perez was a lot more comfortable with the car in the race than he was over one lap.
Yeah. Yeah, well, which I think we all kind of expected, didn't we? We know what a class act Sergio is in the car. And, well, from last season, we could see he has form around Bahrain. So I think it wasn't too, you know, too out of the realm of possibility for him to be really good in the race.
No, I mean, he's constantly been lauded as this tyre-saving god over the past few years. And it's hard to really know exactly what they're talking about, other than his throttle control is what you sometimes hear. But you know, he's left that team that he's been with for so long now into, you know, hopefully what looks like a championship winning worthy car. And the expectation that comes with that, and the difference in driving style, maybe, or you know, setup from the car, even just from a, you know, position or software hardware point of view. And he's still able to do it, it seems. So he's clearly got that knack, you know, all that ability in him just inherently to look after the tire, or to be very soft at progressing throttle application. And it's, but I mean, over one lap, yeah, I mean, we kind of expected him. I expected him to be closer to Max in qualifying.
Yeah, I think I did as well. But I think we can't forget as well, it's been a big change for him. And if you can just quickly, Jake, for everybody's sake and for my sake as well, Sergio's gone from last year's car of the Racing Point being a flat rate design to now being a Red Bull, which is a high rate design. Can you just describe the difference in that for me?
Well, I mean, from a driver's point of view, I don't try and ask too many questions about how that all works. I'm not an aerodynamicist, obviously, but you know, the car inherently looks very different from, especially from a side-on point of view. The rear of the car is quite a lot higher. And generally we call it rate, because it looks like the car is angled very much to the nose, or the front of the floor to the ground. And there'd be various reasons why you would want to do that. But I mean, inherently, I think a lot of it comes from history with Red Bull and with Adrian Newey being in charge there all the way back, you know, when they were winning championships. And it seems to be something that they've always had, or I can remember them always having. And I think Max quite likes it. It seems to be that they're able to design the car around, maybe, I don't know if they designed it around that sort of style to give more front end, but he clearly likes a car that is on the nose and a little bit unstable at the rear, it seems, and he likes to control it with the pedals, or with the throttle pedal especially. And you see him complaining a lot about understeer whenever he has a slight inclination that he has that feeling. So it's right. Clearly not a trend that you see on something like the Mercedes or the Racing Point, where we say we have this kind of flatter flatter rake of the car, where the side profile looks very much more level. And I think it kind of gives this feeling that the car has a bit more stability at the rear sometimes. I mean, we could get into the topic of, you know, why people seem to be thinking, and it looks that way, that likes of Racing Point or Aston Martin now, and Mercedes have struggled more with this rule change, with the chopping of the floor at the rear corners, just in front of the rear tyres. But I mean, inherently, I think the car balance from someone like Sergio's point of view, going from that Racing Point to this year's Red Bull, it would feel like the car is probably very much more direct. And that changes everything for a driver.
I think Sergio's going to be someone we see progress over the season, really. You know, I think it's going to be every round, digging away. And the person, one of the people who's gone the other way to the flat rate design, is Sebastian Vettel. And I hope we see the same for him this year as well. What do you think is his future's looking like at Aston Martin?
Well, it's difficult to say. I mean, you know, in the press, he's got obviously quite a bashing so far, you could say. Yeah. You know, his testing wasn't ideal from his point of view. Again, I don't know so much about the Ferrari situation he had there, but he seemed to be complaining a lot last year about the instability of the rear. Not knowing Charles, but from sort of what I heard about him, and when I went to ART a couple of years after him, when I raced him in 2016, that he is very much more able to drive the car, or when the rear is a bit unstable or a bit more on the limit. And I think what seemed to be from the outside, what was happening, is that I think from Charles's first year in 2019 to 2020, the car was a little bit more towards a pointy car, or a little bit less stable on the rear, at least, you could say. And it seemed to be, for whatever reason, that Vettel didn't quite get on with that. And you would think that going to the Aston Martin, that might help him, because inherently, I think the sort of Aston Martins and Mercedes of this world have kind of always had that strong rear end of the car and have to kind of rebalance the front end to suit. But it's hard to say, because like with the rule changes of this, whilst they say it's this last year's car moved into this year, actually chopping the a noticeable section off the floor does change it. And for that reason, you know, the team haven't got on top of it yet, clearly. He hasn't had enough time in the car, so it's hard to say, but I would like to think that he would enjoy driving that sort of type of car more than what he seemed to have last year.
Yeah, well, I think we can see from testing as well, you know, the Mercedes, Hamilton especially, having some spins in testing. And I think they did make a jump from the test to the first race in the car. So I think for Seb's point of view, I think it should be a better season, but a bit more time in it, a bit more time in it will help.
Well, you can see from Mercedes that, you know, inherently that if you look at last year's car, the W11 on board, it looks nailed at the rear. It looks absolutely nailed. The rear never seems to move, and it's just a case of I saw a video once of, I think it was the Netflix from 2019 when they were in Hockenheim, and you saw Hamilton saying in debrief that he still thinks, whilst it's not as bad as some other cars, he still thinks the weakness of that car was the front axle, which would make sense. And that would, I'm sure, was developed more into last year's car as well. But then this year, it doesn't look as comfortable at the rear. You saw him spin once or maybe twice, I can't remember, in testing.
Yeah, it was twice.
Yeah, and the rear, they clearly are fighting to get that kind of balance back to especially the rear of the car. And I'm pretty sure that's what's happened with the rule change of chopping the rear floor away. And I'm sure Aston Martin is struggling with the same thing. So we have to, you don't have time in Formula One. So I was about to say that you just need to give them time, but unfortunately they don't have it.
Well, especially this year, there's no time with the testing restrictions in pre-season due to COVID.
Yeah, the race weekend restrictions as well.
Less practice time
as well. Especially being from a team's point of view, someone like Aston Martin, I know Sebastian is obviously a top level driver, one of the best the sport's ever seen, and four-time world champion, but he's still a rookie to that team. He's not a rookie to Formula One, and he'll get on top of it, but he has to adapt. And the team even themselves can't really afford to wait that long.
Yeah.
If they want a successful season, obviously.
Exactly. And moving along with the rear end instability and to the start of the race, the Haas boys.
Yeah.
Can I just point out that was a smooth transition, wasn't it, from Mercedes over to Haas?
But it wasn't very smooth from the two of them, unfortunately.
No, the two.
Did you like that transition?
That was good as well. That was good.
It's I mean, I can't speak on, you know, I've never driven an F1 car, especially in a race, but I can just imagine being at the back of that grid and that aero wash that they would have all, especially. So if we talk about Mazepin's spin, you know, it didn't look like he'd just done something stupid. He just clearly asked too much throttle. And the car, I'm pretty sure, was just lacking in. I'm sure if they looked at data, I'm pretty sure he had a lot less downforce than he probably felt or ever experienced in a Formula One car, on high fuel. So I think he just caught him out clearly. And then you see that the safety car for him. And then, you know, I think it was the first racing lap after the safety car, and Mick does the same thing in turn four, basically. And I'm sure it's the same thing that he asked too much throttle, not enough downforce on the car and high fuel when you're running in traffic. And that's something that you can only learn through experience, but it is a mistake still at the end of the day.
I mean, like for people who haven't experienced it, the feeling of being, as Jake said, aero wash in the cars or on, you know, on a bike for me in the toe, it changes the characteristics of, you know, speed, how you go into a corner, you know, it changes everything. So it's a, you know, for those guys, it was their first ever time really being in the bunch, or at the back of the bunch, which is probably the worst place in the car.
Well, the most I've ever experienced in it isn't even in the corner. It was on the straights in Sochi, my only Formula 2 race I did last year. You know, on high fuel in that car, a lot heavier than a Formula 3 car that I was used to. And we're going down the straight, I don't know, like in the tow, probably like 280, 290 or something like that, KPH. Yeah. And there's 22 cars all within the walls, and it acts quite a lot like a tunnel in the end. The wind just, or the air just can't go anywhere. That's the first time I experienced, you know, braking for that first corner that it's easy. Well, not the first time, but the most I've ever experienced that. And you kind of saw that happen with, you know, we talk about Mazepin and Schumacher struggling, but, you know, later in the race, we saw Vettel do the same thing against Ocon.
Yeah.
Where he already lost the position. He pretty much accepted defeat on the overtake, but just pulled back in behind, just behind him, right as they're about to turn into the corner, took all the downforce off the car, and they're only going, what, like, I don't know, 100-ish kph at that point.
Yeah.
You know, nowhere near the speeds they're going in the faster stuff, and he's still just locked up.
Yeah.
It's amazing how much the cars these days rely on that.
And also, you know, but not only the cars, it's how much the drivers rely on clean air to drive with and to actually be able to perform with. It's
well, you see some people in F1 especially, you see them taking some really weird lines. Like I saw Lando, he does it in Bahrain both years, I think, actually, into turn four on the first lap. Everyone defends into turn four, and he just takes the clean line on the outside, all the way around the outside, which you might think would be dirty or longer or more distance or whatever, but he has clean air, whereas all the guys that are stuck in the train on the inside of him don't. So it is interesting. You see guys even pulling out just that exit of really slow hairpins, just pulling to the inside a bit tight. You see in Monza, for example, in turn two, you know, the wings are already very low, and they still pull. They don't run out to the exit curb of turn two in Monza. They pull to the more of the middle of the track to get clean air on the wings. It's even in those speeds, these cars are so susceptible to that.
Yeah, exactly. So tricky start to the season for the Haas boys. And from the sounds of it, it's going to continue with the lack of development this year. That's rumoured for them. So. Yeah, I think it's a bit of a baptism of fire for the two boys. But let's move a bit further up the grid and talk about the McLarens and new power unit this year. Big change.
Looks strong.
Looks strong.
Yeah, I mean, the last 2 years they've had a good car, really, haven't they?
Yeah.
I mean, I know they finished third in the championship last year, but I think the Racing Point looked probably overall the stronger car through the season. But they were still, I would say, fourth, definitely above Renault, using a Renault engine, they're beating the factory team. So they clearly have a very strong engineering team back at base there in Woking, well now. And, you know, the drivers, last 2 years, they've had Lando and Carlos. I've raced Lando. He's obviously very quick. And Carlos, you know, was equal to him and probably over the race, you know, with experience, maybe edged him over the races. But now they've got Daniel Ricciardo, who many think is probably a step up to Carlos.
Yeah.
I'm not so sure. I think Daniel's a very good driver. Also, I think Carlos is a very good driver. And it's very hard to sell the difference. And maybe people might get that first sort of debate going this year, depending on how Daniel goes against Lando. But, you know, if you think about the car they had last year, then just strapping a Mercedes engine into that, you would imagine that they would be, you know, especially with Aston Martin struggles now, the extra Racing Point, that they should be very much ahead of the midfield.
Yeah.
And probably bridging that no man's gap between, you know, Mercedes, Red Bull and Renault, AlphaTauri, Aston Martin. But no, I expect a strong year from them. I think they'll probably be a bit disappointing qualifying in Bahrain. But Lando coming back with the fourth place, best of the rest, let's say, in the race was definitely what they were probably expecting.
I think I think for the meme team, it's looking good, but I think Daniel's going to be a bit underwhelmed with seventh at Bahrain.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we saw it surprising. It's something he wouldn't strike me as this kind of character, but he seems to need time to bed himself into a new car.
Yes.
He doesn't, because he's so confident, you know, especially you think back to the Red Bull days, overtaking and being so depth on the brakes and pushing the car to the limit in Monaco. That whole lap, for example, was just outstanding. Or both of those laps, I think he had 2 years in a row or whatever.
Yeah.
But you saw when he went to Renault that he struggled a little bit to begin with. I mean, he is up against quality drivers. I mean, he had Hulkenberg as teammate at Renault. So it's unreasonable to expect someone like Hulkenberg just to be beaten straight away first time. But we kind of had that opinion of Daniel, I think, that he would be able to do that. And it took him a few races.
It's almost races, personalities outside the car, the bike, are very different always to them. You know, there's a couple of guys who I've raced against, you wouldn't think any of them, get them on the bike, they're like a murderer in it.
Yeah, exactly. And it's hard to say, you know, how Daniel is in his head when he puts the helmet on compared to where we see him, you know, smiling out in the car, but outside of the car, but he clearly needs that feeling, you know, of what the chassis likes and what it wants, how to get that to sort of flatter his driving style as well. And I think, you know, you saw him in the second year with Renault, a lot stronger than his first year. I mean, you could say that the car was stronger, but I think, and he had a different teammate as well, but I would say overall he was definitely stronger, and I think you'll sort of see the same trend through his McLaren career.
So we spoke about Lando with that strong fourth place. Had a good little battle at the start of the race with Charles and the new Ferrari, which has been heavily modified since last year.
Yeah, well, we kept hearing through the winter, it was a very short winter, but even towards the end of last year, obviously, that they were pulling a lot of effort into their engine. I mean, I haven't heard of anything, you know, substantial enough to say what they've done. But it seems to be, you know, just from a very basic level, faster, stronger, more horsepower, whatever. It seems to be helping them. I mean, on board the car doesn't look very different to me, but maybe it's sort of producing, you know, maybe less downforce because of the rule changes, but as a percentage compared to the front runners, a little bit better, maybe. But I think the engine is the main thing.
So over the winter, Ferrari have changed the nose design, so that's quite prominent. We can see and going up the nose and also the engine. I think it looked better. Both drivers, you know, finishing well within the top 10.
Yeah.
Strong result. Good debut.
Yeah, I think they'll be happy. I mean, I would say they probably look the fifth fastest car. Well, actually, maybe even the fourth. Probably the fourth. I would say you've kind of got Red Bull, Mercedes, McLaren,
yeah,
Ferrari, AlphaTauri, it's quite hard to tell. But definitely stronger. They look stronger than where they were last year. And I think they looked, I mean, I saw some things on the interviews afterwards. I saw some few clips from the garage and they all looked quite, you know, smiley and happy about it. So I think they all have it. It's almost a bit of a sigh of relief, I think, that they've moved forward, because I don't think Ferrari as a religion could have took another year like they had last year.
No.
But I mean, we're all very impressed. Like I said before, I think Carlos is a very good driver. I think he was slightly disappointed where he qualified compared to Charles, and Charles fully hooked up his lap. I mean, I saw that on board and it looked pretty tidy. But until that point, he was very, very even between the two of them. And I think he's only going to get stronger as well once he knows the car a bit more and the team a bit better. So that will be an interesting dynamic to watch.
100%. And you've said, and you just said you think Ferrari may be the fourth or the fifth fastest team. Contention for those fourth and fifth places, I think, is AlphaTauri. And we really didn't see the best of them this weekend.
Well, we kind of did in flashes, but we didn't see it from results. I mean, there would be an argument maybe to be had that they could even be the third fastest team if you looked at Barra. It was, you know, you saw Pierre qualifying ahead of the McLarens. So on that basis, you would say definitely the third fastest car. And Tsunoda, I think, was second in Q1. But you know, the car itself looks very easy to drive. I mean, I say that with a bit of, you know, tongue in cheek, but it looks very comfortable compared to what I see some of the other cars on board, and it just looks a bit more plug and play for the drivers, and I think that's giving confidence to Tsunoda, especially as a rookie.
Exactly.
But yeah, I think it will be one to watch for sure. The Honda engine looks stronger. I hear rumors that they think it's very close to Mercedes now. And I think you will see some good things from them this year. Pierre will definitely be a bit gutted about what happened. I think it was the first lap when he hit Ricciardo, I think.
It was just after the restart, after the Mazepin safety car at the start. So I think Pierre's going to be gutted. But Tsunoda, really strong drive.
Yeah, I mean, he would have been... It's weird to say that he would be disappointed with his qualifying result in his first attempt after being, let's say, fast-tracked through into F1, but he was second in Q1. I mean, I raced Yuki in 2019 in F3. We fought for the win together in Monza, and he's not shy, definitely not. And I think you could see that from his overtakes when he's going through the field to I think finish P9 in the end.
Yeah.
So he'll be very happy with the race result, I think. It's clear that he has inherent pace in himself, and I know that as well from, like I said, racing him before. But he'll be a bit up and down to begin with until he fully sort of, you know, smoothens out his sort of adaptation into F1.
Yeah, I think Yuki, you know, out of all the rookies, he's probably, well, out of the three rookies, he's in the best car for sure, out of the three. But he also, he has a bit of passion about him, doesn't he? You know, was it on the Friday or the Saturday he was swearing down the radio?
Yeah, I mean, he's actually, I mean, some of the radio I heard from him in F3 and even F2 was worse than that. So he's very he's very animated. He's, you know, you could almost say very Japanese, for better of a phrase. But, you know, we kind of associate Japanese drivers as being not shy. I mean, I think all the way back when I started watching Formula One and Kimi Kobayashi coming in and just lighting it up, I think, in a 2009 race in Suzuka, and he just kept on lunging everyone at the hairpin.
Yeah.
And that's what sort of opinion I've always had of Japanese drivers ever since. Maybe that's a bit unfair, but Yuki seems to be that mold.
Yeah.
And I think he will, a bit like Max Verstappen when he came in, he's exciting, I guess. And, you know, we always kind of think that these, sometimes I even see drivers come through that are just very exciting, very Red Bull-esque, let's say, because they like a very specific type of driver, and they get a lot more kudos, let's say, than the smooth driver who plays it back in the background and is very much, you know, like a surgeon's knife or something, just gets the result. But in the end of the day, it's a sport, and fans like to see what good drivers like Yuki are like. So I think he'll get a lot of attention through the year.
As you said, like Kamui Kobayashi, I remember Takuma Sato, another great Japanese driver. it's good. It's great. I think it's great to see a Japanese driver back in Formula One as well.
Yeah, it's needed.
But let's talk about the top three to round off Bahrain, Lewis and Max. Was it right? The contentious issues.
Yeah.
What do we think? Was it legal overtake? Was it illegal?
It's, you know, track limits is a never-ending saga. I mean, you think it's just F1. It's not. It's all around the world.
Yeah, every discipline of racing.
You know, you see it in bikes as well. You know, you can't have racing nowadays the way new tracks are designed without having to talk about track limits, it seems.
Mm.
But, you know, what on one hand, I very much like the new sort of rules in the last year or two with Michael Massey being the FIA race director.
Mm.
Clamping down on it. Mm. But what I don't like is the inconsistency part of it.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think they had FP1 or maybe even FP2 where they were all going wide at turn four.
Mm-hmm.
They're all going wide and then all of a sudden they clamped down. You can't do it at all. Your lap's deleted. Okay. Yeah. You should have been done earlier on in the weekend. But okay, now we know that. Don't let the drivers impact your decision because we are all selfish at the end of the day and we just want to go faster.
Yeah.
And it seemed to be that they were doing that. But then you see that Lewis, through the race, is just taking wide all the time, lap after lap. And maybe they got told something on an email.
The ruling for the race was changed. So,
but why?
So
there's no need to. It confused the fans. I'm a driver and I didn't even know. I was thinking, why is he going wide?
Exactly. So the ruling for the race was it's quite difficult to explain, but if you're going through turn four by yourself in a non sort of, you know, you're not battling with anybody, you're just going through turn four. If you go outside of track limits, it's fine. But if you are racing someone and gain an advantage from track limit.
But you're in a race, so you're always gaining an advantage.
Exactly. Exactly. So there was, you know, what we saw was, it was it wasn't clear cut enough.
Yeah.
It should either be, right, you're allowed to use all of it all the time, or you stay keep two wheels within the white line.
Yeah, it should. I mean, it confused the hell out of everyone. I mean, and then obviously when Max comes to do that overtake, he thinks he's going to get away with it. I mean, actually at the same time, I think he was probably sitting there knowing when he got to turn six in the lead that was going to be debated.
Yeah.
Definitely. Maybe not as quickly as it got decided by his team to let him back through.
Mm.
But you know, for the fans, it's just that it's, you rip your hair out watching it.
Yeah.
I imagine. And you probably think, why can't drivers just stay in the white lines or the curbs? And it's not that we couldn't, but it's just, you know, if we know we can go there, we will. That is just, you know, undebatable.
At the end of the day, we're all looking to gain whatever advantage we can within the rules.
Yeah. So until somebody, the race director, the referee in football, whatever, tells you as a sports person that you can't do something, you're going to do it.
Exactly.
And that's not the driver's fault. That's the steward, the race director, the referee, the jury, whatever. But exactly. I just don't like, you know, even the fact that, you know, if you have they were just taking turn four, for example. Mm. But then if you take turn 13, the second to last corner, they're all going off there. So what's the difference? But they seem to say that it's more and I experienced this in F3 last couple of years, that it's more the red and white curve now than the white line, which is not how the rules written, but it seems to be that's what they're applying.
Mm. I think it's not really too much of an issue for someone on the bike side of things, especially because if you're going off that red and white curb, you're a bit screwed anyway. But I think we need something more clear cut, and then the fans will know, then the drivers know, and it's done.
Well, I think what they had from FP2 to end of qualifying was absolutely fine.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But why did they feel the need to change it for the race?
I don't know. Maybe, I mean, the other thing I thought about was maybe that, you know, when they decide before the weekend of these type of things, they normally, like in Budapest, for example, turn four and turn 11, it's always a contentious issue there. They have loops now.
Yeah.
Triggers to sort of, you know, because it is, you can't rely on the marshal or the CCTV to always, you know, these cars are so fast.
Yeah.
It's hard just to get that right every time. And then people will be complaining about inconsistency if someone's missed. But
yeah,
so the loops are there. Maybe because they didn't have it from FP1 that the loops weren't installed. I don't know. And they were just going on visual references.
I don't know, but it is what it is with the Bahrain result. You know, yeah. I think they're going to take the knowledge of what's happened forward, which would be good. And, you know, we'll have something a bit more clear cut. But it was a battle of strategy, and it came down to the wire. So Hamilton obviously won, as always. But,
he's just there. Him and Mercedes are just the force of nature, aren't they?
Exactly. But the Red Bulls are coming up this year. And we saw Valtteri finishing third with the fastest lap. But my question to you, Jake Hughes, is driver of the day.
I mean, Perez has to be up there.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to, I think it, for me, it would be between Perez and Hamilton.
Yeah. I think Lewis's drive was really underrated.
Yeah. I mean, he made those tyres last. I mean,
yeah.
But I can't remember what stint it was, but Bottas just wasn't anywhere near him.
Mm.
I think it was maybe the first stint. Hamilton and Verstappen are so far, you know, it's hard to say really, because I think people like Leclerc, Norris, you know, these guys, Ricciardo, are also maybe on their level or just underneath or whatever. Mm-hmm. But with the cars they're in, they're clearly outperforming their teammates in the last few years. But I think, you know, Verstappen's strategy was a bit harsh in making him look how it made him look, because I don't think he could have done much else in the end. You know, his track position in the end won the race. Track position work versus tyre wear, really. Mm. And, you know, Hamilton's goal was to make the tyres last, and Verstappen's goal was to be able to overcome the track position issue. And in the end, he nearly had it done. And if it was done, if he did get it done, then we might be talking a different story. But in the end, I think you have to say Hamilton did a mega drive just to keep those tyres lasting.
Yep. No, I'm gonna go for Yuki. Solid debut.
Yeah, it's good. It definitely. I think outside of those two, I think he would be up there for sure.
Solid debut. More to come from him, I'm sure. But looking forward to probably my favourite racetrack in the world.
That's mega.
Imola. Oh.
I've only driven there once in a Formula Renault, and it was great.
Yeah, I've done it. I've had the pleasure of doing it twice at World Supersport 300, and it's just,
You guys can't even climb the curbs like we can in the cars.
No, you can't. Like on the exits of corners, they're really weird. Because the curbs at Imola are completely smooth. They're not.
Yeah.
They're not the kind of curbs, exactly. The piano curbs people call them. And on the curbs in Imola, it's the red, green, and white curbs all the way around the edge of the track, and it's just phenomenal.
But I mean, the F1 cars can climb all over the apex curves if they want.
Oh yeah, no.
And especially we could in Formula Renault at the speeds we were going.
Yeah, it's you know, my biggest best memories of Imola. You know, you head out the top chicane is
Variante Alto, I think.
Yes. And then Bass is the bottom one, isn't it?
Yeah, Variante Bass. So it's just top corner, bottom corner, I think.
Yeah, literally.
Like that.
It is. It is actually.
Aqua Minerale, mineral water.
Oh, yeah, Aqua Minerale. That's a phenomenal section of track.
Yeah.
That is one of the best sections of track.
No, but I mean, I'm so happy that, you know, because last year it was kind of forced upon us with COVID that we were able to have tracks like Imola, Mugello, Portimao, Nürburgring. And you saw what fans wanted. The
classics.
Publicity. Yeah, the publicity or the feedback it got from the fan base seemed great. And especially, you know, from my side as well, I loved it. Loved racing in Mugello myself, for one. I wish that was back this year, but I'm very happy to see Imola and then the very next race, Portimao as well, back.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, just like I always think with Imola, just imagine owning the house on the outside as you go down to Ravazza.
So you
come out the top chicane and you're looking dead ahead and you go under the bridge and you go into the braking of Ravazza and you can see houses around the outside of the track, and it's a crazy feeling.
Imagine how much you could rent those houses for.
Imagine on an F1 weekend. You could probably pay your mortgage in
the balcony. Oh, you're only allowed in the balcony, mate.
Oh, yeah.
But It's going to cost you 50,000 euro now, but that's outrageous. But
be phenomenal, though.
It would be.
Unbelievable track. And it's the older tracks have that essence to them.
It's a fear factor as well.
It's a fear factor. It is. It really
adrenaline.
Is. It's, you know, my first, I remember rolling out of pit lane. And obviously, if you've never been to Imola before, one of the first things I think we all do is go to the Ayrton Senna Memorial on the inside of turn two and three and four. And I remember rolling out of pit lane and you see the Brazil and you come into, what's the corner name?
Tamburello,
exactly. And you come into there and you roll through it and you look to your inside and you can see the flags. And then you look dead ahead to the outside and you can see the Brazilian flag that's been there for a long, long time. And it's an astonishing place. And I urge anybody who's never been there to go there.
There's a park on the inside of the track as well.
Oh, there's a stadium. There's an athletic stadium.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
It's like racing
in a Cornwall town or something as an equivalent.
It's like a street circuit, isn't it? Because you literally walk from the town 2 minutes and you're in the circuit. But it's a proper facility and it's a proper circuit.
Imagine how loud it used to be when old V12s were racing or in testing there. Must used to get a bit fed up in the end.
Oh, but they love it though, don't they?
Yeah, especially when it's painted red.
You've got things like Mallory Park in the UK where they're going through
it's not the same.
All these. No, it's exactly the same. Imola, Mallory Park, same thing.
It's not.
It is, not but. Having it. But, you know, Mallory Park goes through all these noise complaints and, you know, they can only operate within certain hours. Imola, they just invite it in.
Yeah. Well, it'll be an interesting race this year. Obviously, last year, the weekend format was the first time it was a bit different in God knows how long. Mm. With just one practice session on the Saturday and 2 days overall. I quite liked it, actually.
I think it really condensed things up and... It added a bit of an element in there because of course we saw Daniel Kvyat finish fourth, which was an unexpected result. We saw, you know, Ricciardo get on the podium and
it's always been known as a track that's difficult to overtake. And I think we were all expecting when the cars would go there, that it would be a bit of a spectacle in qualifying, especially to see the cars flat out through there. But we were all probably anticipating a bit of a boring race. And I quite liked it. I mean, it wasn't an overtake fest. We had enough for sure, but it was more that, I mean, if I take the Verstappen Bottas sort of battle, as an example, probably the best example, you know, that sort of developed over, I don't know how, God knows how many laps and pit stop, I think there was as well. But it was tense, you know, and it was for second and third, but if that was for the lead, that would have been great. I wouldn't have been thinking that I was being sold short just by the fact that they weren't overtaking each other every lap. And the long straight seemed to do that with DRS and enough, just about. I like the 2 day weekend. I mean, we see when practice is washed out occasionally over the past years on Friday that the race seems to be more than not a good one because the teams don't have the data, they don't have the tire wear knowledge, especially.
Exactly.
To know how to set up the car. So I liked it. I'd like to see that back, but I think, you know, this year will be a bit more of the norm, probably.
I think it's an old school track and you get old school sort of racing out of it, which is always good to see. But I don't think it's gonna be a Mercedes procession this year.
No, I would imagine that track would suit Red Bull more than Bahrain did just by, you know, again, I don't have the data or anything like that, but just by the visual of watching the car on board, especially, it looks like it's almost made for Imola, the Red Bull.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm hoping I'm not wrong here because we'll do the review and it's like a half a second Mercedes pole and I'll be eating my hair. But no, I think it will be a bit of a flip side from what happened last year. I think you will see Red Bull probably on pole. If I had to guess, Perez might be second, but I think more behind Hamilton. And then you'll probably see a strategy battle again if Hamilton can stay on. And maybe a bit of the switch between Verstappen and Bottas last year where the Mercedes is chasing the Red Bull this time.
I think the McLarens will be strong. I think they'll be strong. And I'm going to want a bit of a wild prediction from you, Jake, like an outside chance prediction, but mine is going to be Pierre Gasly for the podium.
I was just, no, this, that isn't fair. First of all, I tweeted, it's not fair. I wasn't even fair on him, actually, because I tweeted that before the race in Bahrain, and then he goes and smashes his front wheel off.
Yeah.
So I said I actually fancied him for a podium if one of the three Mercs and one Red Bull, sorry, two Mercs and one Red Bull had a problem. But they test there. You know, they don't test there like they used to. But you see all the filming days.
They did the demonstration laps there as well. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I've seen this onboard helmet visual driver's eye of Tsunoda on YouTube of it, pre-season testing there. Mm. So I think out of all the teams that might know a few little tricks to that place, it would be them, and their car is definitely stronger than it was last year.
Exactly. So that's, well, you've heard my outside prediction. Come on, what's yours?
Oh, I might go Leclerc podium.
Oh, okay.
Again, okay. Italian team, but I think, I mean, he finished fifth there last year. I think, you know, they weren't going to fight for the win, were they? In a normal finishing race, they wouldn't have been on the podium. They wouldn't have got to the podium either. But I think we're kind of all depending on what Bottas and Perez do, really.
Yeah.
As to whether these sort of outside predictions happen. But if they have a bad race, mechanicals, whatever, DNF, lap one, then I reckon Leclerc. But I was going to say Gasly. So
I'm just going to add another outside prediction, because what we're going to do is we're going to... so this episode will go out before the race. And I think maybe on the Thursday, we'll put a tweet out there on the Facebook. We'll put a tweet out, put it on Instagram, Facebook, whatever. Make sure you're following at the HYM podcast. And we're going to put up our outside predictions in a poll, and you guys can choose who you agree with. But I'm going to put two because Nick's not here. Mercedes won't be on the podium.
What?
I know, it's ludicrous. How controversial is that? I know.
So what are you going with? Like two Red Bulls and who? And Gasly?
No, I can see a Verstappen win.
Yeah.
Second, no, shut up. I can see like a Gasly second, and I can see a Norris third. Imagine the scenes.
That's outrageous.
That is outrageous, but can you see it happening?
If you asked me that before Bahrain and just no, I can't. If you asked me that after the test and not after the race, Bahrain, I might have said that potentially, because they looked like the car was a handful. And in the race weekend, it still didn't look amazing, but clearly they had something hiding up their sleeve a little bit. And I don't think the car is as bad as we kind of come to assume from testing.
No, I agree with that. I think they made a big step between the test and the race. But we've only seen the car on track at Bahrain.
True.
They've done a couple of days at Silverstone. It doesn't. Yeah, exactly. But I think, and this is my limited knowledge opinion, that we're just going to see a spicy result out of this race.
I don't think Bottas will be on the podium.
No, I don't think he will be. That's what prompts me to say we won't see a Mercedes on the podium.
Yeah. I mean, we're going to look really stupid.
Oh, it's going to be Hamilton, Mercedes, Hamilton, Bottas 1-2, but you know, we can have,
I don't see that. I actually don't see that happening. That would be, it's not controversial, but I don't see Mercedes 1-2.
No. But as we said, what we'll do is we'll put a poll out. You guys can send us some of your predictions as well, and it'd be good to hear from you on that sense. So that's the F1 side of things rounded up. Quickly, we're just going to have a couple of minutes to talk about motorbikes.
Finally. Yeah, I watched the highlights. I didn't quite get a chance to watch the full race. But...
Well, we've got two races to talk about quickly. We've got Qatar Yamaha 1 and Fest. Qatar 2, funnily enough.
Well, we have a Yamaha race and a Ducati qualifying.
Well, basically, yeah. Did you see the start?
I did see the start, race? Especially the first one was a joke.
Oh, my God. Martin came from like 14th to 4th in about...
It's almost cheating, that device they've got.
It is. You could just go, put a crap lap together in quali. Just put the old Ducati launch on and you're gone.
But the Yamaha looks strong. I mean, obviously, we still see the usual engine deficit. I you know, me being a car guy, I just don't get that after watching motorbikes for so many years of MotoGP now, like as a fan rather than any experience behind myself, like what I have for driving. I just don't understand how they can every single year have an engine deficit. Like, there's no, have they tried? Like, have they tried, or they just can't do it?
It's a $1 million question.
What's stopping them? Like, they think they're going to lose their kind of sort of mid-corner speed, sort of minimum speed thing they have.
Motorbikes are really weird, and in manufacturers, they were saying this on the coverage as well. But manufacturers have inherent characteristics that just stick and stay, and no matter what. And you can go back 20 years, 30 years, and it's the same characteristics there. The Yamaha stops and turns really nicely. The Ducati has great power and good braking stability, just doesn't get turned that well. The Suzuki's all round sweet handling. The Honda is difficult. The Aprilias are coming stronger.
Yeah, Aleix looked quite good.
Yeah, the pro cyclists looked good, didn't they?
Yeah. I'd love to have him on the podcast.
He'd be so, I reckon he'd be a good laugh, wouldn't he?
I'm just going to ask him, how the hell can you do 240, 50 watts average heart rate, 130 when you're not a professional cyclist?
It's crazy. Honestly, he's an incredible cyclist. But yeah, for the first race, we saw, you know, Maverick had a great win. And I was so pleased for him because he just needs that good start to the season. And he really fought for that win. So that was really good to see. And then, you know, the Pramac boys were quick in the first round.
I was just going to say, Jorge, I mean, I don't know too much about him. Did he come from Moto2 or Moto3?
Yeah, so he's Moto3. So
he won Moto3, didn't he?
Moto3 world champion. And then had a really good year in Moto2.
That was it. He already had his contract after Moto3, didn't he?
Am I
thinking of somebody else?
No, for Moto2, he went to the Red Bull KTM squad.
I just seem to remember when he was, I didn't watch so much Moto2 last year, but before I did watch Moto3.
I think he signed pretty early.
Yeah, I think it was him. I remember the commentators on BT saying that he's just made for a MotoGP bike.
Yeah, he's got such an aggressive sort of look to him on the bike.
Have you seen that slow-mo of him with his neck on the floor?
He's basically got his shoulder down. Yeah, he's not the tallest bloke, but you know, he's strong and powerful on that bike, and he just puts it into the floor. But as Casey Stoner, when he was the last person to win a world championship with Ducati, it's what he did with the bike. He muscled it about and he got results out of it. So, you know, the first round, you know, Jorge finished, Martin finished 15th. 16 seconds off the win.
Yeah.
One round later, he's third.
But it's funny, the situation with Ducati and Pramac, I find, because last year you had, what, Dovizioso and Petrucci, and you quite often had Miller and who was the second guy?
Bagnaia.
Yeah, they've both been promoted, haven't they?
Exactly, yeah.
It's not so much Bagnaia, but you quite often saw Miller beating Petrucci and sometimes beating Dovizioso, and it seemed a bit strange for me. And then seeing the satellite team be so strong. But then you go this year, and you go, okay, we'll promote those boys again to the factory squad because you think they're the strongest. But then Zarco and Martin looked like they got the better of them.
I think it's just a credit to the team they run Pramac. It's really just real credit to them. But I also think there's a little bit of an essence of that sort of why does Gasly do so well at AlphaTauri? Why did Albon do so well at AlphaTauri? I think it's that kind of like sort of mindset as well.
Less pressure,
you know, you just get on the bike, enjoy, go. Get in the car, you know.
You're still kind of fighting for something, aren't you, really? Because you haven't, you know, I'm not saying once you arrive at a factory team or Mercedes or Red Bull in Formula One that you've made it. Because you haven't won the world championship yet. But you are still fighting for something, aren't you? And that's
exactly. But I think the thing is, in the satellite team, like Pramac, they're on the exact same machinery as Miller and Bagnaia in the factory squad. So they've, you know, it's not like the AlphaTauri is worse than the Red Bull kind of situation. It's right, guys, you're on the same bike, but maybe the environment's a bit better in
Pramac. Yeah.
So it is interesting. But Bagnaia got a podium on his debut for the factory squad, which was really good. But beaten by Johann Zarco for the Pramac team.
Martin got a pole.
And then, the week later, extraordinary.
Yeah, that's outrageous.
Absolute scenes. I was blown. You know, I knew he was going to be good in GP, but you know,
to be
doing that on your first, on your basically your second weekend, it's incredible. Yeah,
but if you listen to Jorge Lorenzo, that probably no one's going to do anything.
Oh yeah, yeah. But
he's twisted.
I really want to speak to Jorge on this thing. It would be awesome. Because you could just
controversial.
You could steer him into like just giving a really controversial opinion on something. It'd be hilarious. But
where's the next race then, MotoGP?
So the next race is it's Portimao.
As well. Well not as well, but Portimao,
well, it's like
next Formula One as well after Imola.
Exactly. It's Portimao as well. But touching on the race two at Qatar. Fabio Quartararo really pulled it out of the bag. I think Maverick could have been with him if he got through.
Yeah.
But it was an absolute dogfight of a race. It really was. You know, Mir and Miller really got into it.
Yeah.
Got into a big scrap.
It seemed like the Yamahas needed like two or three laps to build up to it, be able to overtake in the right spot, to be able to build a big enough gap that they, you know, because if they were overtaking in the last sector, they were going to be second or third, you know, in turn one. So it needed to be earlier in the lap.
And I think they were really clever with their tyre conservation. They just sort of sat mid-race, you know, chill out, boys. There's nothing too bad going on here. We know the Ducatis are going to drop off. And when Fabio decided to go, he went and best ride of his MotoGP career by far.
Looked like he was almost thinking the same thing.
He was in control. He was really in control. And, you know, from third, Martin finishing third as a rookie, outstanding. But from first to 15th was covered by 8.9 seconds.
That's nuts, That is nuts. Like, that's why everyone loves MotoGP.
The closest top 15 finish of all time.
That's why everyone loves MotoGP.
It's brilliant, and it's brilliant to see what Dorna are doing and what the FIM and ERTA and all those guys are doing with the regulations is working, because it's creating close racing from loads of different manufacturers.
I think I'm quite excited to see the Yamaha rider situation through this year, because I actually think Quartararo is good for Vinales.
Yes.
I mean, Rossi, legend, but...
Yeah,
clearly. I mean, you can see his performance on the
races,
Petronas bike.
He had a great qualifying at round one, fourth, but
he has that every now and again, and then he's just back in P17. You think, how many time world champion, seven time world champion, or something be doing that?
Seven in MotoGP, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just like I wonder if there was a lot of blaming about the bike maybe going on last year, you know, about it not being good enough to win the championship and Suzuki come through and do what they did.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, maybe they have really updated the bike. I'm speaking from a bit of naivety here, but it strikes me as like the classic, the new guy comes into the team in Quartararo, and in Vinales' case, now you're the senior guy and you have to step up.
I think, you know, Fabio and Maverick, I think they're riding in similar ways as well. There is that newer style, newer way. So I think that, I'm not saying Rossi hasn't changed and evolved, but I think those two are more, you know, more with the time almost. And then if they're both working in the same sorts of styles, they're going to move the development in the bike in that direction. And they're going to help each other. So that's a factor. But the person I felt most sorry for all weekend and both Qatar races was Frankie Morbidelli.
He was nowhere.
Second in the World Championship last year. I just feel, you know, you finished second in the World Championship, and you know your teammate gets promoted to the factory team, and you're in the satellite team. And
does he not have the same bike?
No. I think it's a year. I think it's a year older chassis, or the chassis is different, or something, or the engine's different. There's, you know, they're not on. It's not like a Ducati situation where it's equal machinery.
Yeah.
So I do feel for him, but it was an incredible opening couple of races in MotoGP. Moto2. Shout out to Sam Lowes.
He won both
of them. Just incredible. Yeah.
be good to see him in the win the championship against MotoGP.
Exactly. And then Moto3, we saw one of the most incredible races of all time with Pedro Acosta going from pit lane to win.
But that seems like every single race in Moto3 is just the best race of world, all time.
No, but that's...
Stop watching cadet racing and karting. Yeah.
So I've been on track with Pedro. I'm nowhere near as fast as him. When I've been on track with him, but I've seen him at like places like Cartagena, and honestly, the kid is... The things he was doing like 15, 14 on these 600s was incredible. So, and, you know, saw him in the FIMC EV Championship last year, doing great stuff, and won Red Bull Rookies. So I think moving up to...
Well, not even one to watch, one to...
You know, he's expect. Already... Exactly. So all round, a great couple of weekends, and bring on GP action.
So why don't we finish the podcast quickly with your predictions, and I'll even chip in myself for Portimao with that just quickly, like we did with F1.
Yeah, yeah. So go on, you can ask me.
Well, I just did. What's your predictions for MotoGP?
Oh.
Portimao, that was quite a simple, really.
That was actually, wasn't it? going off last year, it's hard to go off last year because Michelin have brought new compounds to GP and... The KTMs aren't liking it. So I don't think Miguel Oliveira is going to repeat his victory from last year. Mm. I can see Maverick being strong still.
Did Quartararo win the race? No, it was Oliveira.
It was Oliveira.
They only had one race, yeah.
Yeah. Miller, Maverick. Oh, it's so difficult because it's so close this year. Miller, Maverick, Zarco is my prediction.
I'm gonna go with Quartararo with one of the Ducatis. I'm gonna go Martin just to be controversial.
Just to be really controversial.
Yeah. And then why I say Quartararo, Martin. I'm gonna go Rins actually.
That's solid. That is solid.
But you can't really go wrong, can you? Well, you can because you are gonna be wrong. It's not gonna, you know, it's almost impossible to predict it, but no one can shout at you and say, what are you doing? Because it's so tight.
I think that's the good thing with GP. We can't go, what are you doing with that prediction? Because it is so tight.
I believe in yours.
You know, it's not like saying Mercedes won't be on the podium and Gasly's going to get a podium at Imola, is it?
Yeah, you're asking for attention there.
You're asking for too much there. But that's been the HYM racing weekend debrief. We haven't decided on a name for it yet.
Don't worry about this, but you'll see it in the title.
You'll know what it's called when we put it out, but that's been our sort of like race roundup, and we're gonna continue these throughout the year. And you know, with Jake and Nick on the F1 stuff, it's really, you know, it's going to give you guys a great insight. You know, Jake's working alongside Mercedes, Nick's working alongside Aston Martin with the simulator stuff, so those boys are going to be able to give a real deep dive into the Formula One side of things. So keep joining us for this show. Please leave a rating down below. They really help us out, and leave a comment as well. Like, subscribe onto YouTube, follow us on all social medias at HYM Podcast, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, TikTok.
Yeah, we're on TikTok now.
Yeah, me and Jake spend way too much time on TikTok throughout the day. Do. So
yeah,
we had to create one for HYM. But we'll keep these coming to you, and we'll catch you in the next one.
For the poll on Twitter as well about about the predictions.
Yeah, we'll get that going, and we'll get some of your, you know, if you've got any questions for the boys as well, roll those in, and we'll answer them in our racing shows. But we'll catch you next time, guys.
Cheers, guys.